Welcome to All Business No Boundaries, a collection of supply chain stories by DHL Supply Chain, the North American leader in contract logistics. I'm your host, Will Haywood. This is a place for in-depth discussions on the supply chain challenges keeping you up at night. We're breaking beyond the boundaries that are limiting your supply chain. Today's episode is Decarbonizing the Supply Chain with Diageo, Path to Zero Emissions. Our guests are Lucy Fishwick, Vice President of Logistics at Diageo, and Stefan Shablinski, Vice President, Go Green, North America for DHL Supply Chain. Let's dive in. Well, welcome both of you. Great to be with you here. We are in Las Vegas at Manifest Conference on day one, and you guys are hot off the stage from your industry panel, which was one of the first events. And I was telling somebody in the hall, this event generally starts a little more sleepily than it has today. There are a lot of people here, and we had a really good turnout for your panel session. So what I'd like to do is just kind of start with self-introductions, your name, who you work for, what your role is there, and how long you've been at it. And Lucy, can you lead us off?
Yeah, of course. Okay. So Lucy Fishwick, I am Vice President of Logistics for Diageo North America. Hopefully you've enjoyed our brands. Diageo is one of the world's largest premium drinks companies. We've got 132 manufacturing sites, and we sell our liquor across 180 different countries globally. I look after our logistics operations. I've been with Diageo 10 years, predominantly most of the time back home in London, but I moved over at the end of March to take operations role. But previously been in procurement and led our Great Bus sustainability team.
Great. Well, welcome. Thanks for being with us today. All right, Stefan.
Yeah, my name is Stefan Shablinski. I'm the Vice President of Go Green at DHL Supply Chain North America. Go Green stands for our decarbonization program. And this is my 24th year with the company. And I spent the last 15 years in our decarbonization arena. Most of the time I spent in Europe and Asia, but since 2021, and my focus has shifted to North America.
Good. So we have two imports to North America with both of you. And I want to talk about sort of geography effect and how the markets are different, and kind of what you're bringing from a perspective, having been overseas in other parts of your career. But first, you know, Lucy, you had talked about at Diageo, there are, like many other companies, you have set carbon targets.
Of course. Diageo's ESG program is called Spirit of Progress, Society 2030. So we've kind of got quite a broad program that focuses around three core pillars. The first pillar is all about positive drinking. So it's really our license to operate. So it's about promoting positive drinking, and DHL participated in our drink awareness program. The second pillar is all about championing diversity and inclusion. And then the final about pioneering our green to our sustainability agenda. From a carbon perspective, I think it'd be fair to say we've got pretty bold targets and ambitions. So from a scope 1 and 2, so that is the carbon within our own footprint, we're looking to be net zero by 2030. And then when we look in scope 3, which is the carbon emissions which sit within our supply chain, we're looking for an absolute 50% reduction by 2030. When you take into the growth that we've had enjoyed in the first 4 years of this decade, that's actually going to be more like a 75% reduction in bill debt.
Wow. And you had mentioned there were sort of three components of the supply chain side.
So we've got the decarbonization, which obviously I just shared the goals there. Then the second program is all about preserving water, as water is the most important key raw material for us in our alcohol production. And then the final area is all about circularity and recycled content.
Okay. So Stefan, sort of a 101 on sustainability. Real quickly, what are scope 1, 2, and 3?
So on scope 1, carbon emissions are emissions that stem from diesel, gasoline, and electricity. So these are scope 1 emissions. Scope 2 emissions are emissions that come from electricity and power plants. And scope 3 emissions, which are the hardest to measure and also to reduce, are emissions that come from our transport and supply chain burdens, like subcontractors and carriers.
Okay. And so is that complexity why the target is 50% instead of, say, 100?
Yeah. Really, within our own four walls of manufacturing, we've got a lot more control. And once we start looking into our supply chain, it's going to be how well we can collaborate with the various partners that we've got within our supply chain to unlock these carbon emissions. So I think the 50% is still quite ambitious. Mm-hmm. I think it feels like we've got quite a long way to go.
Okay. So that's a good segue into DHL and Diageo. So what's the historical relationship been? And then what are you guys working on today, or maybe, you know, sort of where we started to partner up to address some of these targets that you guys play out?
Yeah, that's a longstanding partnership between the two companies that goes back many years. and spans across all scopes, scope one to scope three. I remember when we take the time machine back to the year 2014, we discuss the deployment of electric yard trucks. And if we go back and travel back in time to this year, that was a technology that was not really available. And yet we felt we need to do something new. We need to be innovative and invest into a clean technology. And so we partnered up and we figured out that electric yard trucks is something that's feasible. And we gave it a go. We partnered up with the company RNGV, who was the first in North America to come up with this technology. And we were the very first companies to deploy this technology in the real world operational scenario. And I remember that back then we were wondering, you know, for how long we are able to operate this yard truck, because we didn't dream that this is something that can operate over many years. It was really set up as a first trial, as a test. And we thought after a year, we just shut it down, take the findings and figure out what next to do. And it's amazing to see that Sparky 1, which yeah. is the name that we gave this very first electric yard truck, is still working hard day and night at the Diageo distribution center in Illinois. And it was not only the perfect customer to pilot this new technology with, but also the perfect operation, because it's heavy duty. It has somewhat extreme climate conditions in summer and in winter. So it was the perfect operations to test this technology, and it proved to be feasible up until now.
I think the irony of it is we took a diesel truck that got converted into an electric vehicle. So the battery is still running. Sparky 1 and Sparky 2 are very much still in operation 9 years later. But the truck itself is rusting and falling to pieces around us, whilst the battery and the kind of underlying technology is still working. So that's definitely been a learning for the future.
For our non-supply chain listeners, what is a yard truck? What is it there?
So a yard truck is a heavy-duty vehicle that typically operates within the yard property. And it moves trailers around the yard and is a quite critical equipment that allows the, you know, the flow of products and goods inside, into the warehouse and outside of the warehouse.
So I think we're probably even more critical in our manufacturing site at Bingo, because we actually have node warehousing on site. Okay. So they are moving all the packaging materials to the line, and then they have to clear the line since they because we got the nowhere in store on the site, and then we ship it down the road to our warehouse. So it's a real critical bit of kit that keeps the trainers moving around.
Yeah. And so it's sort of 10 years into the pilot.
Yeah.
You talked on the panel about the notion of piloting and how it's been important for the sustainability agenda overall. How does Diageo think about that? And how did you identify yard trucks as a potential area?
I think what we've really found as we've been going on this sustainability journey is when the technology comes out, it is cost prohibitive. And as a corporate that has shareholders and stakeholders to report to, it's really critical that we are continuing to expand our margins, develop our productivity pipeline. But one of the ways that we've found that we have had some success with both DHL and a couple of other partners is doing that pilot scheme. So, you know, we invested in Sparky 1 and we invested in Sparky 2. At the time, they were significantly more than a diesel truck, but we had those two trucks in our business for the last 9 years. We've got a huge amount of understanding and learning the advantages in having an electric yard truck versus a traditional diesel one. Probably one of the biggest ones, but it's maybe a somewhat of a surprise is how much more the drivers are operating the electric truck. You don't have the noise, you don't have the vibration, you have the smoother ride, less wear and tear. So what we've had is these two trucks in our operation for the last 9 years. We're now actually looking at how do we replace all our yard vehicles with electric trucks. And 9 years later, that price is almost parity to diesel. Mm. But what we have is now the experience of what do you need to be considering? Don't put them in all diesel vehicles. The battery will outlive the truck, but like, you know, we've got that experience, we've got the confidence that the technology is going to work. And it's a way for us to be able to try different innovations with a little bit less risk and a less financial commitment.
Right. So how many yard trucks do you have total in your fleet, would you guess?
I think we've got another 12 to that.
Yes, 12 that are currently in the process of getting converted to electric.
I mean, it's interesting when you think about the size of the company, Diageo, and then you think about one truck. It seems like small, right? But the piloting concept does seem to make sense. And I mean, I think you had a good consumer example in the panel of something that I was skeptical about as a consumer whenever that legislation came down. You're going to talk about that LED.
What's really mind-blowing if you go and see this technology in real life and compare them next to each other. If you see the diesel truck and the electric truck. But there's this one example that I always refer to, lighting. And we all used to use these conventional light bulbs in the past that you weren't able to touch after 10 seconds this light bulb being pushed on because it was just too hot.
Mm-hmm.
And that means it was not creating only light, but also heat that you don't want to have in the light bulb. So it was just wasting a lot of energy. And nowadays, we're only using LED light bulbs. And if you go to a store, you would only see LED light bulbs. And I remember in the early days, people were complaining about the LED, you know, the color of the light. It was not, you know, as nice. You couldn't dim it. But technology evolved. Prices come down. The lifetime of these light bulbs, LED light bulbs, is 5 to 10 times longer than the conventional light bulb. And you only consume a fraction of the energy for the same light, for the same output, so to speak. And we just see the same now with these EV trucks. They consume considerably less energy, less maintenance. The drivers are super happy. There's no exhaust, no emissions. And in hindsight, when I look at these EV trucks, it's almost like in the early days when we all learned how to swim. We learned how to swim at a pool. And it was a safe environment. And, you know, there's always the edge of the pool. You know, if you get into trouble, there's always someone to help you. And it's the same with these EV trucks because the charger of the EV truck is always close by. And, you know, we learned how to swim in the yard with EV trucks. And that gave us the confidence over the past 9 years now to take it to the beach.
Uh-huh.
And in our case, it means take it to the road and invest into class 8 electric road trucks. So, and if it wasn't this example with the Diageo, we wouldn't be at a place right now to understand how to deploy electric vehicles on the roads that go like 100, 200 miles, and they don't see a charger until they come home at night. So that was really a great example how to take a pilot from being a pilot to something really that helps us to bring this technology, but also an adjacent technology to scale over the next 2 years.
What were the factors that went into your thinking around where to put the yard trucks? Diageo has multiple facilities around the country and the globe.
So Plainfield is our biggest manufacturing site in North America, and it's often an area that we're going to pilot something. We want to do it in a site that we've got kind of 2 degrees of confidence in. If you test on the biggest waters, it works, right?
Yeah.
If it works in Plainfield, which would be by far our biggest manufacturing site, you'd have confidence that you could roll it out to any of our sites.
Yeah, okay, good. Stefan, you talked a little bit about the Class 8 trucks, which are probably behind in the evolutionary curve from the yard trucks. As you think about piloting those and putting those into the fleet, what factors are in your mind about where you're deploying those?
It follows a similar approach that we took for the EV yard trucks. We do not only want to put these trucks where they work best, you know, where the climate, the weather, the range is just perfect for this technology, but we want to push them to their limit, which is why we decided to deploy these electric over-the-road trucks across the country from California all the way to the East Coast. And we use them for different types of operations, with different payloads, with different operational profiles, under different weather conditions to really figure out, okay, what are the differences between the diesel and the electric, and how does the electric behave in different environments?
Okay, good. We talked at the beginning, and you guys are both not from the United States. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what the sustainability environment looks like in your home country and compare and contrast to what you found in the States and how that kind of factors into your business decisions as you're trying to drive these agendas forward.
That's a different question to answer because we have seen these different geographies in different times, so to speak. I've seen Europe in the early 2000s. I've seen Asia in the 2010s. And I've seen Europe again in 2015, 16. And now I see North America. And I think overall, everyone progressed. And that's probably the biggest learning that I've made in the last 10 years or so, that the topic of sustainability and decarbonization has gone mainstream. It's on the media, it's in the news, it's in the boardrooms. It's something that no one is shy talking about anymore because we all see the criticality and the importance of it. And I think this is the biggest accomplishment that I've seen in the past years, that it's not only with a few scientists and experts, but it's a topic that is discussed broadly and invites so many more stakeholders into the conversation, from sales to finance, controlling, everyone's on board. And this is important because sustainability people are not the best at finance or the best at sales. So by teaming up, we are able to make this financially appealing and a proper concept that we can present to a customer. And it's no longer a boutique concept, so to speak, but it's a product that we can offer to customers. And that, I think, makes this journey of decarbonizing your fleet so much more powerful than it ever has been in the past. So I wouldn't make a big difference between geographies necessarily, but I would say that overall, we have just matured a lot over the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I'll step away from logistics for a moment. Okay. But I used to buy glass for Diageo, and you know, we're one of the world's biggest glass buyers because a huge part of our portfolio is sort of glass bottles. And it's really interesting to see where the different regions are from a glass decarbonization. So in the UK, we have a great partner. Well, we have a couple of great glass partners, but one has announced that they will be investing into hydrogen furnace. So really cutting edge, obviously glass. You're heating the fan to 18,000 degrees Celsius. Sorry, can't do my American translation.
That's all right. That's all right.
But hot. So it is incredibly energy intensive. So they have invested into hydrogen. They'll be bringing a hydrogen furnace online in 2025, which is going to be really revolutionary for the industry. Mm-hmm. Well, then you flip it over to India. We talk a lot about how do we unlock the circular economy and how do we get into returnable packaging. But in India, 40% of our bottles are second-hand bottles. Mm-hmm. So there is a whole sub-industry that will go around, collect bottles, wash them, and then resell them back to the original brand owner. So they will deliver us back our portfolio of glass bottles second hand. But we haven't been able to unlock circularity in the UK. So it's really interesting to see in different regions and different environments where there'd be the necessity, maybe a scarcity of demand, etc., that already adapted, and you're seeing different routes to fundamentally the same problem with how do we decarbonize that.
Interesting. So from your vantage point in your role, you're able to see all of those different developments happening globally. That's got to be pretty interesting.
In my old role. Now I'm North America logistics. Don't worry.
Okay.
Back to the topic of electric vehicles, which I find interesting is that when the concept in North America really caught on, suddenly we see so many OEMs coming to the table. I think we have more OEMs with an electric vehicle product in the United States than we have in Europe, which is interesting. And we also see when we talk about the next generation of electric vehicles that don't rely on the big battery anymore, but on the fuel cell. Again, in North America, we have more OEMs that are taking the step to bring a fuel cell electric truck to the market in the next 2 to 3 years. And that's something I find very interesting.
So explain, how does a fuel cell work versus a battery?
So maybe we start with why we need a fuel cell truck. The electric truck at the moment relies on the battery, and the battery has a finite capacity, which means that the battery electric truck can only go a certain mileage before it needs to be recharged. Even though there are some manufacturers that provide a distance of 250 up to 300 miles, or maybe one provider up to 500 in the future, it's still not enough for the majority of the work and the majority of the fleet. So the fuel cell electric truck is still an electric truck, but it doesn't rely on a battery on board, but it has a fuel cell on board that turns hydrogen into electricity on board. So basically the truck produces the amount of electricity that it needs to run the motor, so to speak. And that gives us a higher mileage. And since the batteries are heavy, and the fuel cell truck doesn't need these heavy batteries, it also gives us a higher payload, which in many applications where we haul heavy freight is important.
Like liquor.
Like liquor, especially where we go a high distance or high mileage. So we need a technology that gives us both the mileage and the payload.
And I think in a very real example, so we're working through at the moment, obviously we've got the electric yard trucks, but we've also got a dedicated fleet that DHL manage for us. And we're looking at, in that dedicated fleet, do we want to invest into electric or hydrogen? And kind of one of the real aha moments for us was an electric vehicle will not be able to do a full shift for a driver. So then you'll have that vehicle out of action 2 to 3 hours whilst it charges, whilst the hydrogen truck will be able to be refilled in 10, 15 minutes. So it's that, how do we get the right operational efficiency when, as I said, we've got to keep the lights cleared at main tilt. So kind of really maximizing that utilization of the truck is really good.
And again, I think this is where the partnership is so critical to advance this early kind of technology. Like with the yacht trucks, we were the first to embark on this technology together with a partner, RNGV. And I think it helped them tremendously to advance that product up to a stage where it can be offered to the mass market, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's a standard product for us. We only deploy electric vehicles. We try to avoid diesel when possible. And I think this partnership across the value chain from supplier to DHL to all the way to our customers is not only nice, but it's so critical for the market to advance their products and bring them to scale and to market.
Like, say, kind of 95% of my volume moved isn't with the WV or the electric yaw trucks. We have kind of other carriers outside of it. We need to go and test it so we can have the conversations with our remaining carrier base and understand what they're doing. It's something that we can collaborate on and share those learnings.
Yeah, interesting. I gather there's a bit of a supply problem in terms of equipment in any of these new technologies. How do you guys team up to address those constraints?
I think what's really fruitful and important in our partnership is that we both try to understand the in and outs of this technology to manage each other's expectations. And now it's a technology that takes time to deploy. It's a technology that takes time to train the drivers, operations. So everything is different. And we don't have the expectation to push the button and everything works perfectly from day one. I think both of us are aware this is an early technology and we have to work jointly on getting this right. And this is what's so important. If we were to work with a customer, we have the expectation to have a perfect new technology working on day one, this wouldn't work because then we would kind of, you know, not be honest that we try to make this work instead of just pushing the button and having it work from day one.
Yeah, so two heads are better than one.
I think also what's been quite interesting is the level of ownership probably from both teams. Like, they're excited to trial this technology. Mm-hmm. There's a real sense that we want to make it work and how do we work together to unlock that. And sense of pride in Sparky One and Sparky Two and some of the innovations that we've done together.
But apart from technologies, and when we touch on Scope 3, I said at the beginning, we work together with Diageo and Diageo with us across these three scopes. And again, when I think about North America, and Will, you asked earlier, what are the differences between the regions? I think pragmatism. The U.S. is very pragmatic, and we try to track this Scope 3 problem, you know, collecting data from our carriers, for carbon accounting, on the reducing CO2. And there it was in the U.S. with the U.S. EPA SmartWay program. They have started to collect all this data in the early 2000s. And I think it was the first time that together with Diageo, we try to use this data. And in an RFP process where we talk to our carriers and said, hey, are you a SmartWay carrier? And if yes, what's your score? And we use these scores not only for our carbon reporting together with Diageo to get our Scope 3 data right, but also in the way we select our carriers. And that's the perfect kind of circle of using the data for your accounting, but also for your carbon reduction. And that's something that is kind of unique when you look across the globe, so to speak, how you manage Scope 3 with the US EPA SmartWay program. It's really something that's extremely powerful, working not only with the carriers who are part of this program, but also then with your customers and the shippers to use these data effectively to kind of try to select carriers not only on price and service, but also based on carbon emissions.
And carrier diversity.
And diversity, correct.
What do you mean by diversity?
So, working in collaboration with our transport management company, we have ambitions to increase the amount of spend that we have within our supply chain, so like a cargo. So what we have is total visibility when we do the RFP of what is the cost benefit or increase of each scenario, what is the carbon impact, and then what's our percentage of spend. And that's with a diverse carrying.
Okay, great. Thank you. Lucy, you were at Customer Club this fall. We talked a little bit about this topic, and I think my read of the room was the majority of people there said, in essence, my company really is committed to environmental targets and improving. But when push comes to shove on cost, they had a hard time. So I wonder if you could comment, what's Diageo's view on that? And then what would you advise your colleagues who were there about how to kind of navigate that puzzle?
It's the forever challenge, right? We are corporate that have shareholders that we have to deliver margin enhancements to. And for me, sometimes you get a unicorn and you get a project that's going to reduce your miles on the road and hedge your costs and have a beneficial sustainability impact. And I would say logistics is one of the categories where that is more often than not is the case, because the more efficient that we are, the less empty miles that we have, the less anyone is spending money on. So there's a lot of benefits in sustainability projects with logistics, but also I think we can't get away from the fact that some of this green technology might have a cost premium of 30 or 40%. And that's why the kind of piloting scheme has been really helpful for us, because you can make a small financial commitment whilst you go and build your productivity agenda elsewhere, make that investment into the technology, understand the technology, and then hopefully by the time you get to scale, you've actually had the commercialization and it starts to become more cost comparative with traditional technology.
But I would also say that we should not only look at cost and cost being the reason for not investing, because I'm looking at this like, I'm not a video gamer, but I remember I played Super Mario Brothers, where you go from level to level, and cost is just one level. When I talk to some customers, I tell them, okay, let's pretend cost is not the issue.
Yeah.
Let's talk about all the other issues that we might run into, and let's find a way to solve them first. And now, is this technology the right one in the first place? And if not, you know, is there a better one? And then tackle the cost issue maybe in the second step, but find a solution for the challenge that you have, which is to decarbonize. And then let's get back to the cost question after this and see, you know, if there's a solution for this. But you know, in some cases, I've seen we got funding and cost was no longer the issue, but there was something else that kept us from investing. So don't put everything on cost and don't get too focused on cost, but you know, look at the broader scheme of the issues that you all need to solve to make it work.
Good. Well, it sounds like having a good partner in that exercise is important.
Yeah. We don't leave any stone unturned. We look at all the stones and try to figure out, okay, what it is that we can do together. Now, what is the, at the panel, you mentioned the abatement costs. You know, what is the cost of carbon, per ton of carbon that we can reduce? And then let's start with some of those that are easier and cheaper to decarbonize and set aside some project that looks at the harder to decarbonize and see what we can do together as partners to make them work in the future. So that's how we approach it a bit.
Well, thank you both for being here today. I liked the panel and I really enjoyed this private conversation with you. Good luck for many more years of partnership and progress on this front. So thank you both and enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to rate us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also re-listen to our entire library of episodes on our website, dhl.com/ABNB podcast. See you next time.